You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. Well, guys, thanks for joining us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. Everybody wants to know how to find exponential growth or create exponential growth with our hard-earned money, which is the rate at which that happens is the velocity of capital. So today we get to dive into that concept in a case study with Paul Shannon, who's the founder and the principal of Red Hawk Real Estate, and how his money is making babies. So I don't know if we can say that. Can we say that?
I think we're probably okay right now.
So Paul, how you doing, man?
Gentlemen, thanks for having me on the show. I'm doing great. How are you guys?
So you're our neighbor, just a hop, skip, and a jump over in Indianapolis. And you said the Evansville area. So Paul, give us kind of some context into the man behind the myth prior to real estate investing.
Prior to real estate investing, life was pretty straightforward. It was like Mulberry Street, you know, nothing too exciting. I was in sales most of my career. I'm originally from the East Coast, Boston, Massachusetts. I have a wife, three children, 10, 8, and 4. So we're in the thick of things there. We relocated to Indianapolis about 9 years ago now. In those 9 years that I've been here, I was in capital equipment sales, medical device sales. I was selling the implants and all the equipment that's used for cataract surgery. So ophthalmologist was my call point. Was up early in the morning, usually out of the operating room in the mid-afternoon, but making calls or on my computer till fairly late at night, doing a lot of traveling. And as my kids were being born and as they were growing older, I was kind of seeing that the writing was on the wall, that I wasn't really going to be around for their upbringing, which wasn't really aligning with my values. So I had done some investing in real estate after having analysis paralysis for years. Got started in single family like a lot of people do and had a little bit of success. I was using the BRRRR method to kind of recycle my capital. And BRRRR stands for buy, renovate, or rehab, rent, refinance, and repeat. So I was just kind of using that strategy to extract my money out of the deal once I had finished with that process and then redeploying that capital into other deals. And it worked pretty well for 3 or 4 deals. They went fairly slow over probably 6 month time periods per each. Mm-hmm. And I saw that I was able to kind of, you know, grow my capital with an infinite, or I should say I had a finite amount of capital, but I was really able to grow that infinitely. And really what was missing was just the time that I could dedicate to the process. Right. Mm-hmm. And there were some things going on in my life along with my kids being born, the time commitments for work, and, you know, a few other things that just sort of led me down the path to say, you know what, at that point I was 37 years old and it was sort of time to take a risk on myself. I wasn't going to do it now. If not now, when? So I made that leap. I had the support of my wife, which I couldn't have done it without her, and gave myself kind of a 2-year runway to make a go at real estate. And thankfully, you know, hit some tailwinds, admittedly, with the COVID, you know, crisis, there was a lot of doubt as to where any asset class would be, but real estate caught some heavy tailwinds during that time period, which helped me out. But was fortunate to meet some great people, some great partners, have some success, work hard, and all those things have allowed me to just stay in the business till now. So excited to still be a part of it and still chugging along.
Oh, that's awesome. Can we maybe back up? Can you talk about maybe what it was like for you to first jump in? You said you had struggled with a lot of analysis paralysis. So what was that first deal like? I know you said it was a BRRRR, but maybe just give us a little bit of context on that deal and what made you finally pull the trigger after kind of battling with that for a while.
Which, real quick, you did forget a letter in the BRRRR, and our coworker, he said he puts the B into, or the bleed into BRRRR. So it's buy, bleed cash and time and resources, and then rehab, you know. So I've kind of reinterpreted that. Anybody who's done that before, we talk about how it, like the YouTube videos, the ads that pop up on your phone, they're like, do you want to make $10,000 in 6 months and 6 hours, you know, passive income? But it's like, it is grueling. There is a grit that has to come with it. So anyway,
yeah,
BRRRR.
I love that. I'm going to steal that if that's all right. No, I definitely had some stumbling blocks along the way there, and I didn't buy any courses or buy into any gurus programs. I just went with my gut. I had a couple mentors that sort of helped me along the way, but really once I got into the thick of it, I realized, hey, this is me. I have to do this. Nobody else is going to be here to hold my hand. So But leading up into that, back to your question, Garrett, I mean, I had probably 4 or 5 years of analysis paralysis where I was really interested in the idea of flipping homes initially, read a ton of books, but always had this fear that I was going to lose my entire principal, whether it would be like a contractor ripping me off or there'd be some title issue I didn't see. And I really just didn't understand the process, I guess, was the biggest thing. And I was a pretty conservative guy and actually remain a conservative guy today. The difference is that I take bets on myself a lot easier. Like I believe in myself a lot more. And I think there was a limiting doubt back then that maybe I can't do this or I need, you know, an employer to kind of have my back because I'm not really comfortable with the idea of having variable income or uncertain income. Today, I feel fully confident that, you know, what I touch is either going to do one of two things. It's either going to be wildly successful or it's going to be a complete failure. But if it's the latter, I know that when I fall down, I'm going to be able to pop right back up and learn from that mistake and then continue to go down the path. And it's just putting one foot in front of the other. So that's kind of the mindset change that I went through. But my first deal, I bought a duplex and it was an older home. I never ended up going through a heavy renovation with that property, but I did get to manage the tenants that were in there when I inherited the property, deal with a lot of maintenance issues that were deferred, build some relationships with contractors, learn property management software, learn how to just kind of deal and interact with tenants to have a good landlord-tenant relationship. And I had that property for a few months. And then I bought a property at auction, which was a, you know, a heavy lift. It was a big rehab, single family home, 3-bed, 2-bath. And, you know, it wasn't the easiest project in the world. I hired a contractor who I ended up having to babysit. I ended up having to be at the property while he worked alongside him to know that the work was actually getting done. He was charging me by the hour. We kind of breached some things in the contract. I didn't get that part of it. And I, you know, he took me for a ride a little bit. I probably overpaid on a lot of stuff. I think he had a party one night at the house. There was a fight. The cops were there. So all this stuff, you know, all these horror stories you hear that, you know.
You said this was your contractor or your teenage son? It sounds like you described like parenting a teenager, like party late night.
I'm sure that'll probably happen someday, but no, this was the contractor. And ultimately at the end of the day, we had a solid outcome. I ended up filling that house with a tenant and they stayed there for 3 years. I sold that property on contract actually recently. So now I hold the note for it and still am able to capture some income from it. Wow. We did like a wraparound mortgage and all the stuff that I had no idea about at the time, but collected rent for like 3 years. I did refinance that property and did a full cash out refinance and some. And that was a huge confidence builder for me because it told me that, you know, even though everything doesn't go perfectly as planned on paper, you can have the best plan in the world, but once you get, you know, punched in the mouth, like, right? Isn't that the saying? Like, you don't know. You just have to kind of go with it and figure it out as it comes.
Yeah.
And was still able to have a positive outcome. So that gave me the courage and the confidence to kind of push forward. I did similar projects with less headaches, I'd say, for the next 2 or 3. And that led me up to about 2019 when I left my W-2 job and decided to go all in on real estate. And that was really, you know, what I said before, like it was a time issue. And I thought if I could dedicate 100% of my working hours this year, I'm going to be able to scale this much quicker. So that's what I did.
So you took 3 single family deals or like a duplex, burned all of those. And I know the one you said that you refinanced, do you hold all 3 of those still today? Or have you sold a couple of them and you hold one of them now on the paper side? Or
I've got a couple of them on the paper side, if you will. The rest I sold. They were in Indianapolis during the initial stages of COVID when property prices held up pretty well. I decided to de-risk a little bit and take something off the table. I had kind of stopped investing in Indianapolis. I had managed about 10 homes at one point. The BRRRR strategy wasn't penciling as well, probably right about 2020 time period. I wasn't able to get all of my money back out of the deals. At that time, I wasn't borrowing private money. I was just using my own. So I had a finite amount of capital. And I was concerned that if I was leaving some money in the deal, eventually, you know, I'd run out of deals because I'd run out of money. So we borrow private money today, and that's less of an issue. But at that time, it made me kind of look at tertiary markets where the return metrics looked a little bit more favorable. And I looked at a few different markets near you guys, Toledo, Dayton, up in Fort Wayne. I landed in Evansville, which is about 3 hours south of where I live. And I met a property manager down there who's now my partner. We've done probably close to 100 rehabs together at this point. We really scaled quickly.
Wow.
And he was a catalyst for me to do so because he enabled me to, I guess, take some of the things off of my plate that were really holding me back, like trying to manage properties and trying to manage lease ups and learn property mm-hmm. management software and be so close to my assets that I was constantly driving by them and making sure everything was okay. A little bit of a perfectionist problem there. Whereas if it's 3 hours away, you really have to delegate and lean on mm-hmm. somebody to take over ownership of those types of responsibilities. So he was the one that did that for me. We coupled a partnership with another guy who is a broker who was doing a lot of transactions between investors, both on the buy and sell side, and was passing on a lot of them and pushing them off to his clients. Whereas now he's part of our ecosystem and we get first look at a lot of these deals. So our deal flow is picked up along with the operations side. I deal with a lot of the lender stuff, insurance, taxes, underwriting, and making sure we're, you know, staying positive. So, yeah, it's been a really good partnership, and that's sort of where things kind of transition, where I'm mostly in Evansville now because I don't like to manage properties. I don't have a strong of a team here. We do own a 40 unit apartment building in Indianapolis, which I was project manager on, but I hire third party property management for that and right. just stay away from the lease up and the day-to-day operations.
I think what's cool about your story, Paul, is you've had some really good touch points in a variety of different areas when it comes to residential investment real estate, like when the single family side, the Burr method, some multifamily stuff, getting in that rhythm, having to deal with the property management, the construction management. It's given you kind of a well-rounded education, so to speak. One of the things I think is interesting about your story is, and I think a lot of people are finding themselves kind of in the middle of this journey of, I've saved up, you know, an initial kind of nest egg of capital. Maybe they're trying to deploy it or have successfully deployed it. And now they're trying to velocitize that. They're trying to compound those returns. And that's the beauty of real estate, right? Is versus investing in Amazon and Apple and waiting for them to release quarterly earnings, you have more of an active role in making that happen. The problem is we all get very antsy and impatient during that process, right? Especially when you are used to the past 5 years of property appreciation and cheap mm-hmm. money, it kind of, everybody was drunk on that, you know, those are the variables economically. So walk us through, just if you can, from a numbers perspective, not asking you to pull the curtain back on your finances, you're welcome to, but the first one, you said you pulled all your money out and then some, then you scaled up to about 10 houses in Indy, sold most of those, hold a couple now, and then you alluded to the fact that you got into multifamily. Can you even just pick one of those threads and just show us some numbers about how money can velocitize when you're able to exit and redeploy that?
Sure. Well, let's start with an example of like a single family BRRRR, and then let's apply that to commercial multifamily, which is a little bit different, right? As far as how properties are valued. So like with a BRRRR property, essentially, you want to be all in, meaning your project cost, your acquisition cost together should be no more than 75% of what you think the appraisal will come out at. So let's apply some numbers. So if you buy a house for $50,000 and you put $25,000 in, you're at 75, that property needs to appraise for 100 for you to get that 75,000 back out. So you've basically created that 25,000 in equity as your down payment. Out of nothing, right? Really just the value that you put in the sweat equity, mm-hmm. more or less. That's the BRRRR method.
With your first one, what was your acquisition price, rehab cost, and then what were you able to pull out of it?
That house, I bought at auction for 55, right about there. Put 30 grand into it, and it appraised for like 140.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and we were going to rent it for 1200. So we were able to pull out more than what we had had in it. I think I pulled out like, I was in it for 85. I pulled out like 105. I'm not saying everybody should do that, especially not in every deal, but because we had a big buffer as far as the rent we were going to get versus what we had into it.
So
it did
what
make
was
some
your
sense.
Cash flow then net on that property after you put the mortgage on it?
About 150 a month after all expenses paid.
So you pulled out $25,000-ish more than what you put into it through acquisition and rehab, and then you had a cash flowing rental on the back end of it.
And that's infinite returns.
Right, because your money's all out. So then what did you do with that money?
We bought another one. So we kept that going. In 2019, we bought maybe 25 houses or so, roughly. Wow. They were all BRRRs. There was a couple flips, but all the rest were BRRRs. And we did those with, you know, when I say 25 houses, I mean 25 units. There were a couple 4 units. Mm-hmm. But there were some big upsides on those because they were vacant. They were disasters. So we just started taking on heavier and heavier lifts. We had more capital because we were taking out all of our money and we were kind of using credit lines at that point. And then we started to build relationships with banks. So the money started coming easier. We eventually started to borrow some private money. So it kind of like snowballed, if you will. And then of course COVID happened. And like I said, I divested some of that money. But then as you looked at the Federal Reserve kind of pumping dollars into the market and printing money, so to speak, I thought to myself after, you know, going back to a lot of the reading that I had done before and reading about monetary policy through books like The Creature from Jekyll Island, you know, what's a good investment to be in or a hedge against inflation? Because you figure if they're going to put this much money back out there, it's going to devalue or debase the currency. I thought, well, what better investment to be in than real estate? So we're back kind of to square one. It's like, hey, I still have some assets here, but we really need to double down. And I feel like there's a really strong thesis and story behind multifamily right now. So started, you know, kind of like exploring the idea of getting into larger assets and had gotten wind of a seller who was a little bit of distress through my property manager partner and just picked up the phone. And I actually got the guy who held the note on the property on the phone. And he said, you know, this is the person who's actually operating the property right now. You want to talk to them. So I got her on the phone. We spoke multiple times over the course of 3 or 4 months, and we finally came to a deal. It was an exhaustive negotiation, a very difficult process. But in this case, it was sort of applying the Burr method to this property. But with commercial, if you're looking at it from a value add standpoint, you want to know if you're really adding value. What you want to find are properties that you can produce a stabilized yield that has a spread above the terminal cap rate or what you would sell the property for, the cap rate that would be applied when you sell it. If you can achieve that, you can't miss. There's no way. If you can operate a property, you can have yield on cost, if you will, of let's say an 8% rate and the market cap rate is 6%. That means you can sell it at a 6 cap. You're going to create a lot of value when you do that. And that's exactly what we did with this particular property. Had a yield on cost of like 11% on paper. So there's huge upside. It was a pretty heavy value add. It was 70% occupied when we bought it. It had it was 40 units and had only 6 that had been renovated. The rest were classic from the 1970s. It had all of the original cast iron plumbing and a lot of plumbing calls coming through.
Yeah, there you go.
That's not the part of the project that added value per se from an income statement standpoint, but from a future buyer, they will appreciate that. And we appreciate operating it without all the plumbing problems it was having. We had to replace one of the roofs. It was 2 buildings, 20 units apiece. We had to replace one of the roofs. We had to solve some drainage issues. We had some bad tenants in there, non-payers, some crime. It was a mess, honestly. But I knew at that point, I had built a track record with my property manager who was yet to be my partner at that point. And I trusted him that he could handle this. He had actually managed this property 7 or 8 years prior. Mm-hmm. He knew it pretty well. I'd seen him execute on a budget before. I'd seen him do all the things that we had to do at this property on single family homes. So it's just a bigger house, right?
Right.
Entrusting him to kind of execute the vision, it was great. And we found a good lending partner who, I didn't do loan to cost in this deal. I really wanted to kind of be pretty conservative. So I came with a down payment for the property and then I funded the CapEx out of pocket. And, you know, fortunately rates had declined so much by the time we were done with the project that we're able to lock in for 10 years at 4.15%.
Wow.
And we still have, when we refinanced, that was what, the beginning of last year. So we've got like 9 years left till maturity. We've got a cash flowing asset that clearly covers the debt service by a lot.
How'd the refi shake out on that one?
How so? Like, was I able to get my cash out?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 100% cash out refinance. I didn't take out any extra, and we were at a 72.5 loan to value at that point. Mm.
Wow. So here's what's so cool about this, and I want to try and connect some dots for people who are listening. You start in the single family. The BRRRR was a strategy, which right now, with rates being as high as they are, you know, probably isn't as much of a strategy unless you can find just a phenomenal deal. But still, finding value add distressed assets, and instead of pulling the lever of renovating, you know, to improve the physical structure, you started pulling the lever of income and NOI for the multifamily side of things. And we're still able to execute that strategy, but at scale for the multifamily side of things. And for every property that you continue to hold, you experience the principal pay down and the appreciation and taking that money out and redeploying it. So when you are operating in this kind of strategy, especially when you've been doing it for like 3 to 5 years, I feel like that's kind of the time in the market of working that strategy where you really start to feel the impact of it and you start to see the light at the tunnel. Because at first, you're just money out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. You know, as fast as you can make money from your 9 to 5 or whatever your main day job is, you're redeploying it.
Dumping it.
And you're cash poor. And you're like, man, is this really working? But when we say velocity of capital, that's what we're talking about. All of those variables kind of working in tangent together and then giving them time still to mature and work on that. So here's what I want you to talk about, though. What is the tension between long-term hold and then knowing when to exit an investment and redeploy that capital in a different area, geography, property.
Or reinvest that capital. Reinvest podcast. Sorry.
Shameless plug.
Oh, there it is. Right? Yeah, I didn't even notice that sign behind you guys. Yeah. That's a tough question because it's so situational, you know, based on the asset, based on if you've, you know, been solicited and you've got an offer that you didn't expect. Based on opportunity cost of holding it versus moving on to something better. You know, right now, as you alluded to, Seth, there's some kind of dynamics in the marketplace that don't allow for the value add multifamily kind of strategy to work. And I would concur. I would agree. You know, you've got negative leverage where you've got interest rates that are higher than cap rates. You've got a wide bid and ask spread. You're restrained by the amount of leverage you can use because the debt service coverage needs to be 1.2, 1.3-ish.
Right.
And, you know, to hit that, you know, you've got to provide a significant amount of equity in the deal. So your returns are going to be lower. So, you know, it's not always the best time to stick with the same strategy. And that's why we're kind of shifting gears a little bit right now, because we see that you don't always have to hit a home run. That's kind of my business model, is to go for those value add type deals. And we've shifted back into single family this year heavily because we're finding it there. I think a lot of that has to do with my relationships and my partners. but I think also diversification is critical, and that means amongst asset classes. It means even the stock market and bonds and all this other stuff that real estate people don't necessarily love to talk about.
Right.
But it also within asset classes means that you can invest in, let's say, a 5% coupon clip or a triple net dollar store, for example, that's just going to be consistent, that has a creditworthy tenant with a long runway left on the lease in a good market at a good intersection. It's never going to make you rich, but it is going to balance out your portfolio and offer a little bit protection from volatility and kind of complement some of the other, you know, assets that you might swing for the fences on. Maybe it's a development deal, or maybe it's a really, really heavy value add, or whatever that might be. So I've always invested passively in that type of stuff. I've taken the approach that, you know, I want to diversify away from myself as an operator, and I'm not comfortable personally, like, investing even in multifamily, even though I have experience doing it in, let's say, Atlanta, Georgia, actively, because I don't have boots on the ground there. You know, I'm just going to buy something and then show up on an airplane every couple of weeks and expect things to go well. It's a recipe for disaster. So, but I would partner with somebody that's an operator down there who's got 5 deals in Atlanta, who's been crushing it, who understands the market, has the core competencies in the relationship. I would invest passively in that deal and participate in the upside that the Sun Belt offers, for example, that I can't get here in Indianapolis because it's more of a cash flow market.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't invest in a self-storage facility. Personally, I don't really understand that business. You know, it seems actually a little simpler than multifamily, but what you don't know is what gets you. And there's something that I don't know about that. that, oh, one of my friends does know about. So here's a portion of my nest egg. You go take that and run with it. And that offers me diversification in asset classes. So I kind of like the idea of focusing on what I know best and I have experience with, and maybe, you know, taking small little baby steps outside of that box, but I'm not going to take a big leap outside of it. If I do that, I'm doing it for diversification geographically or asset class wise or from a sponsor standpoint, away from myself.
I think it, you know, depending on your personality, it takes discipline to diversify yourself, because if there's something in front of you that's working or that you like and gravitate towards, you're kind of like, why wouldn't I just keep putting money in that? Especially if the returns are good now, good today. And it's hard to peel away a portion of your capital and put it into something that is maybe a lower yield and more stable, especially when you embrace the active part of real estate investing.
I think it's easy to trick ourselves too and look historically, especially with how things have been crazy over the last 5 years, is I've been able to get 12 to 15 to 20% return on my capital by doing the single family house game or doing the, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, whatever you've been doing, and realizing now that the economies are changing. Obviously our debt environment is totally different. And if all your eggs are in that one basket and that faucet gets turned off, you're going to be in hot water or you're going to stagnate. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just, even though the 5% triple net dollar store is not maybe a sexy investment for someone, it provides something, it fills a need. So
there's utility, and everybody has different investment criteria. I will say that I think limited partners on the passive side of our business need to understand that returns are one thing, but if you apply risk and turn it into a risk adjusted return, if you look at it from that lens, it becomes a lot more clear, right? So like, I see a lot of deals out there now that might advertise like 18%, but if you look at the underwriting, it's a tough way to get to 18%, right? Oh, right. The path forward is pretty hard. And I don't know if everybody really recognizes that. Yeah. Whereas like, you may be able to put out like an 11, 12% offering today, that's really soundly underwritten and has a very high probability of reaching those returns. It's just difficult to sell because passive investors are so used to these higher returns. So I think there's kind of an adjustment phase going on right now. But I think everyone needs to kind of reevaluate risk adjusted returns versus returns. And I look at multifamily and where I was from a risk appetite standpoint and where the market was back in 2020 and 2021, where I was taking bigger swings, and there were asymmetric returns involved with participating in these types of deals. You could have outsized gains if you're willing to take on the risk and execute appropriately. Today, the balance has come back in, and it maybe even swung the pendulum in the opposite direction, where the risk is really high. Even if you execute perfectly, if cap rates expand on you, there's a macro piece to this puzzle that you can't control as an operator. If that happens, you could be underwater pretty quickly. And if you're buying in markets that have like a three cap, you know, you're going to feel the pain worse than really anyone. So
no, and that's a good word. That's the discipline that limited investors, limited partners have to have. Is not to get so fixated on the number, because everything sounds good on paper until you are having to do a cash call, or they're pausing payouts, or the asset is so distressed that they have to, you know, exit prematurely. And it's hard because there's a lot of younger investors, not even just young in terms of age, but even young in terms of investment career. They could be 40, 45, 50, but just now getting into investing. But your exposure to the market doesn't have the track record to look back and feel the lows and the highs. We were just talking with a guy today who's been a commercial real estate broker and investor for a long time. And he was like, yeah, I thought I was going to hit the side of the mountain in 2008, 2009. Well, that shapes the way that you approach investment now when things are really frothy and you see people throwing out the big returns, that you're like, I'm not going to get caught up in the hype, because that can go away in an instant. So that's a good word. If you're listening to this and you're evaluating sponsors and operators, don't just chase the tier one market and the place that everybody's saying to invest in, because you can get, you know, outsized returns.
Yeah, we're going to jump into our smaller pockets segment here. So go ahead and tell us, what was your worst real estate deal? It could have been one that you were doing by yourself, or maybe it was some sort of syndication or joint venture that you were a part of. What was the worst deal? Give us some details on kind of what happened, and then what was the outcome, and then what did you learn from it?
Good question. I'd say I have emotional regret about one deal. I mean, I think the lessons you learn from mistakes, first of all, are so valuable that it's hard to say I wish that didn't happen, because it kind of reshapes your outlook, right? And how you approach things in the future. So I've had a couple deals on the active side. One was the first one that I mentioned on the podcast about the Burr method on my first deal and all the things that went wrong, but it actually turned out pretty good. It was a year and a half ago, we were flipping some houses and we got caught with some inventory at a time when rates were going up, and we ended up doing a bunch of work over the course of 6 months and sold them at basically a break even. So if you count your time, that was kind of a frustrating event, but we didn't lose money, thankfully. And we borrowed private money. We were able to pay our investors back in full and still have good relationships with them. So there's been experiences like that, but I think that's all part of the process and understanding that, you can't always get on base every time. But I think one deal that stands out was a passive investment deal. And, I wanted to deploy some capital at the time. I liked the market. I kind of felt like I wanted to build a relationship with this operator, and maybe not for the best of reasons. I didn't vet the deal properly. I thought the debt was a little bit aggressive, but I said, you know what? This person has a lot of units. They must have a track record. Right. And just got caught up in it a little bit, honestly. And, I usually, along with knowing the sponsor for a long time, being patient, I really vet the deals and try to underwrite them as if I was an active investor in the deal. And I didn't do any of those things. Ultimately, my gut told me maybe you should hold back on this, but I did it anyways. And we've had a rocky ride holding onto this asset. So it hasn't really panned out as well I hoped it would. And, it's a lesson for me to say, stick to your criteria, stick to your guns, and don't be overly aggressive. Even if it is a deal that pops up and, you've got some capital to deploy, that doesn't mean you have to deploy it today. Right now I'm sitting in a high yield savings account waiting for better opportunities. So, but again, I think those types of situations kind of help you mature as an investor and make you realize, that there's emotions involved sometimes. And usually that's what gets you. So there was that for me, but also just kind of reshaping, my investment criteria and understanding that, for example, like bridge debt is playing with fire a little bit. So you got to be ready. And is there a rate cap? Is there contingencies in place? Are they well capitalized? Is it something that can be ridden out? Is there a long enough hold period potential to kind of weather the storm? So all those things, lessons built, lessons learned, and no regrets.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Those are the tuition of learning in the hard knocks. You learn those more than the ones you learn in the classroom or a YouTube video. So
there you go.
All right, man. Hey, Paul, we're going to go into what we call our little nugget. So this is one practical takeaway or a piece of advice or just a tried and true principle that you live by that you can give to our investors, our listeners.
I would say, partnerships are critical. And you guys obviously have a good one, a working relationship between the two of you. You realize this. It's critical to growth and scale in this business. And scale doesn't necessarily have to mean assets under management or number of units. I consider it growth from within and just moving one step forward in front of the other. And I think when you form partnerships, you need to be really careful about who you get in bed with, more or less, per se. You want to be aligned as far as your values, as far as, the term of your relationship. If you're going to partner with somebody that's close to retirement age and you're 30 years old, like how long is that runway? And what does that look like when you're getting in with an illiquid asset and estate planning and things like that? You want to make sure that your skills complement one another. I can tell you from firsthand experience, if you partner with somebody that's just like you, has the same ideas and the same skill sets, you're not going to be any farther ahead than you would have been if you had just been by yourself. So, like I mentioned with some of the guys that I've been able to partner with, I couldn't do what they do ever. I'm just not skilled in the fast the business that they are in. I think I learned those skills at a very elementary level, which helped me kind of identify what's good in a partner and how to sort of manage a manager, if you will. But I am by no means an expert in property management or brokerage. So those skill sets are a huge benefit to me because they're a gap in mine. And if I can kind of meet people that have skills or I see potential in I think that's important. I'd say to your listeners, that would be the biggest thing, is just finding good partnerships and evaluating them in the sense of a complementary relationship versus somebody that would be your best friend. It doesn't have to be your best friend. It just has to be somebody you know, you like, you trust, you can talk to every day, and they can do something that you can't that helps you advance further.
Yeah, I think just two comments on what you said. You used the phrase getting in bed, and it's kind of a graphic image, but it's very, it is a very personal thing when you get into a partnership with somebody, even if you doesn't feel like it when you, when you're looking at it on the onset. You don't know how intertwined your life is with somebody until you start sharing debt together at a bank and you are
how romantic
making, making commitments to each other in terms of what you're going to do and roles and stuff like that. And people's livelihood, like that's all very real stuff that can get really real very quickly. So, I think that's a good piece of advice that way. But yeah, just in closing, man, I want to give you an opportunity. Tell us about Red Hawk Real Estate. And just give our listeners the pivot that you have made and where you guys are putting your energy in now. We'll start there.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate the platform. It's been a fun conversation with you guys. So Red Hawk Real Estate is my active arm of my business. That's where we do the single family. We have opportunities for investors to invest in the debt side of things with us for that particular facet of our business. We do multifamily properties. That's kind of been on pause due to some of the challenges we talked about earlier in the podcast, but both single family and multifamily. The pivot that we're going through right now is actually, I'm pretty excited about this because we just inked the PPM and the operating agreement yesterday. Red Hawk is going to be partnering with the Left Field Investors Group. And if you don't know the Left Field Investors Group, check them out, guys that are listening. It's a fantastic community for passive investors to network with one another, to network with sponsors, to vet sponsors and deals, kind of keep on top of what's going on in the marketplace and sharing experiences and sort of education plus community put together. But they have a fantastic community. I'm super excited to be invited into their circle. But we're going to be starting a fund that's going to be investing in residential debt loans as well as commercial equity deals. We see that there is a gap on the sponsor side and the ability to raise equity. You need more equity for deals like we kind of talked about earlier, but also passive investors have kind of tightened up a little bit. So it's become more difficult for sponsors to raise equity. So we feel like with the community behind us, we have a solution to a problem that's in the marketplace. But also, you know, we feel as though there's a piece of the puzzle missing sometimes for limited partners where they get a little bit of shiny object syndrome and they'll look at the, you know, the flyer and say, oh, IRR of 18% and cash on cash of 7%. And we got an equity multiple of 2.1, sign me up, where they really don't look under the hood and kind of check into the underwriting and really understand the metrics like yield on cost, like we talked about, what are the kind of red flags and in the deal and where's the risk, right? So really kind of mining for that risk adjusted return versus just what's offered on the offering memorandum. So, you know, hopefully we can bring significant capital to sponsors deals. We can negotiate better terms and we can get our investors better returns through that. The fund is called InvestWise Collective and it's going to be kicking off here very shortly. So we hope to have some offerings to bring that are going to offer those strong risk adjusted returns. And whether that's an industrial self-storage, mobile home parks, retail, you know, we're looking for yield and, you know, risk protected place. So.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, and just to explain for somebody who may be confused about a fund versus, you know, a specific syndication deal, the fund is more, a bucket of money that could be deployed towards multiple different investments kind of on an ongoing basis for a set period of time versus one property in one project that's just more of a one-off type commitment, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So we're going to be investing with other operating partners and they're going to be operating partners that we've invested in individually ourselves as limited partners, whether that's me or the other guys that are part of the Left Field Investor Founders Group. And so we're taking a limited partner position. But our fund is a little bit different in the sense that it's customizable in a way. So there is a minimum of $50,000 to get into the fund, but then the investor has the ability to dice that up into $25,000 slugs into different deals. So the fund could hold 10 different assets, but an individual investor might only be in four for $100,000. And then that investor would get a single K-1 for all those deals. So it kind of simplifies things for us as fund managers, but it also simplifies things for the investor, where they sort of get to hold their money in a brokerage account, similar to like a sweep account that you might have at Fidelity, where you don't have it in any stocks or anything. It's just sitting there ready to buy whatever you'd like.
Right.
It's similar to that, but in a real estate offering type of setting.
Well, by the time this is going to drop, this is probably about a month and a half out. So what's the best way for somebody to look this up, learn more about it, learn more about Red Hawk Real Estate?
Yeah. Thanks again, guys, for the platform. My website is redhawkinvesting.com. You can find information about my active business as well as the InvestWise Collective Fund on there. You can also go to leftfieldinvestors.com, which I'd encourage you to do if you're in the space and you're a sponsor or you're, you know, a limited partner, just looking for a community and more information about a lot of different topics or sponsors that you've not heard of or asset classes that you might not be educated in. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So those two websites. You can find me on LinkedIn too. I put a lot of content out on LinkedIn, try to offer some opinions and current events and such. So those are the three best ways to find me and find the InvestWise Collective Group.
Everybody's got opinions put out there. I'm just kidding. Yours are just good ones. So yeah. Well, Paul, dude, it's been awesome to have you on. Thanks for talking and breaking down kind of as a case study, how somebody could look at your journey and realize that they can employ the same strategies and principles that have led you to where you are. Even if their goal isn't to be where you are today, they can still velocitize and really compound their investment through real estate, which we love. So, dude, awesome stuff. And thank you so much.
Garrett, Seth, thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.